Mike Netzer, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. And Mike, you are the Vice President of Sales at Data Center Hawk. Helps people make better data center real estate decisions. And we'll dive deeper into like what that means and what you guys do. And you know, to give some context around this conversation, the reason why I wanted to have it was data centers. You know, I've been doing some research, being involved in, you know, the metaverse ecosystem, and realized that data centers power basically our modern society. And in my opinion, will become even more important going forward in our future as our future becomes more digital. And I discovered your podcast, actually, which is called the Data Center Hawk Podcast. And it's really, you know, you guys have everything from like at the high level, like what are data centers, to really nitty gritty, you know, detailed topics around data centers. And I was like, okay, well, got to have Mike on board. I want to talk to him and learn all about data centers and really have like a one-on-one conversation, not only for myself, but for other listeners that don't really understand about data centers. So that is the context of this conversation. And before digging, you know, deeper into data centers and all that, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so I joined Data Center Hawk about 4 years ago, almost exactly. And before that, I had no experience with data centers. And obviously, you'll find that with a lot of people in the space. And part of the reality of it being a somewhat unknown industry for a lot of people is that a lot of people who are in it didn't know what it was before they got in it. It was the case for me. So in the last 4 years, it's been a pretty wild ride, as we'll talk about in a few minutes about what's happened in the industry. And so I feel pretty lucky to have joined when I did. I think people who joined 1 or 2 years ago, up to 10 years ago, probably feel that way too, given what's going on. But a lot of change is happening. And again, that's how I got into the space. Again, I had prior relationship with David Liggett, the founder of Data Center Hawk. And he has asked me to join firm back in February of 2019. And it's been a great ride just from, you know, working at a small company where previously had worked at bigger companies, and working with a guy I'd liked and known before joining the company it's been really fun. So excited to talk about the space with you.
Amazing. All right. So can you describe like what is Data Center Hawk and what exactly do you guys do?
Yeah. So we're a platform that tracks the real estate side of data center industry. And so to put that into context, like there's groups that talk about how many servers are in the data centers or what kind of servers they are, what kind of market share does NVIDIA have versus Dell versus HP. That's not us. We're focused on the real estate. So where are the physical buildings? How big are they? What's their occupancy or vacancy rate? Who's building? Who's bought land to build data centers in the future? And then on the flip side of that, where are the biggest customers in the space? So I'll give you a $10 word here, oligopsony, which is a big way of saying there's an industry in which there's a small number of buyers versus like a, you know, like a monopoly is where one person is the seller and they can kind of do what they want with pricing. And oligopsony is what's in the data center space, where there's four or five really big buyers, and they really dictate the terms of the market. So we have spent a lot of time kind of tracking what those groups are doing. They will build their own data centers. They will also lease significant amounts of data center space from like data center operators, like multi-tenant or co-location data center operators. So that's a big focus of the platform. And so really helping people make better decisions around, am I looking to invest in a data center? Am I looking to build one myself? Am I looking to buy land to develop a data center? Am I a big customer and I want to lease data center space? Like what's a good price to pay, or what's kind of market pricing rates and vacancy, and where do we think it's going in the future? So that's really the story we're trying to tell. So if you kind of go back to the founding of Data Center Hawk 2014, you know, David was doing data center real estate brokerage with CBRE, and there's plenty of products out there for office real estate, industrial, retail, multifamily, as far as everything I just described, like buildings, where they're at, how vacant they are, et cetera, lease rates. But there wasn't anything for data centers. And so that's why he started Data Center Hawk, to kind of fill that space, that void for data centers, you know, for data center professionals. And so that is what we are today. We're an online platform. We do a little bit of custom consulting work off platform, but the majority of our business is people subscribe to our site. They can come in and access our analytics. They can search data centers, everything I just described.
Who are the people that are subscribing? Are these like people like me who are intrigued, or are these like, you know, large corporations that have billions of dollars to potentially develop data centers?
Yeah, primarily the latter. So our customer breakdown is primarily the data center operator. So all of the large groups use our site, and brokers who are doing, again, what our founder used to do, we use it in the same way they would like a CoStar or like a Real Capital Analytics or any of those sites, if you're familiar with them. And then investors are a big and growing customer group for us, as you know, when the pandemic hit and a lot of other commercial real estate asset classes, you know, tanked or dipped for a couple of years, you know, data centers and industrial were really the two that had any positive growth from 2020 to 2022. So that garnered a lot of interest from the investor class to see, hey, how do we get, you know, a piece of this? And you got to see with interest rates so low, there was just so much money out there that those are probably the three groups that used. There's some other kind of smaller groups, but it's mainly groups who are very active doing work in the space.
All right. So I want to dig way deeper into like everything that you guys are doing specifically, but before I want to get like the high level 101. So like, what is a data center? How do you describe it to someone who pretend you're talking to your grandmother? Like, how do you describe like, hey, this is what a data center is?
Yeah, there's a couple of analogies that I think work well. So one is if you just think of your computer, a data center is just a very, very large computer in that it has a couple of things. It has storage, so like a hard drive where just information is stored. It has a processor where it's, you know, doing calculations or computations, whatever. And then it, most of the time, connects to the internet. So it sends information, receives information back and forth. So a data center is going to have all three of those components. It's going to have, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of servers, which are basically like a computer without a screen for your listeners that maybe don't know what a server is. And a lot of those servers will just be storing information. A lot of those servers will be computing information. So if you like go on Google Maps and you say, I want to know how long it's going to take me to drive to Atlanta, which I did last week, looks at the data that it has, it calculates the route, and then it gets that information back to you. So that's all done, you know, powered via a data center. So another way, so that's again, huge buildings that store all that information. You know, the tagline that we'll use is where the internet lives, which sounds a little bit tongue in cheek, but it's really true. If you go and watch a Netflix video or a Facebook post, or you log into the IRS website, like all of that goes back to a data center. And so these buildings, they're, you know, huge and only getting bigger. The industry has grown. It's gone from maybe a 5 megawatt building to a 10 megawatt building to a 60 to 100 megawatt building. And I'll explain what that means in a second, but they're massive, highly secure, really to be built so that there is, you know, basically zero interruption, what the groups in the industry call uptime. And so you'll see facilities that advertise a 100% uptime. Hard to actually guarantee that. Now, we certainly see that in practice. Most facilities don't ever go down, but most groups will call it 4 nines or 5 nines. So 99.9999% uptime. So it's saying over the course of a year, you'll have like, I don't know, 10 or 12 minutes of downtime, or maybe even less than that. So real quick, this is not super important probably for the general listener, but you know, these companies will have like, if you think of like your house, you've got a power line that comes in and then it powers your house. And if the power line goes down, you're kind of screwed. Data centers usually have two feeds in, so they have redundant power feeds, and then they have generators. Power feeds ever go down, they have generators that kick on automatically. And then in the 20 to 30 milliseconds it takes for the generators to fire up the big battery packs that power the data center. Because you know, back when it was desktop computer, if you unplugged even for like a millisecond, or if the power just flickered in your house, everything shut down. Now, new laptops, obviously, you can just unplug the power cord and keep doing what you're doing. That's probably more equivalent to a data center. It's got that battery power, so you can keep working interrupted. So if you hear, you know, most people's probably familiarity with data centers, every couple of years, you'll see a CNN article or an MSNBC article about Facebook's data center went down or Amazon's data center went down. And if the costs for those outages measured in whatever it is, advertising revenue or e-commerce revenue is, you know, in the millions of dollars an hour. And so, and everyone freaks out when that happens, but that's why these things are so critical. Or, you know, talk about self-driving cars, or with the outage a couple of weeks ago with the air traffic controllers. I don't know if that was specifically related to a data center, but there's some highly critical applications that depend on this. So any downtime at all is, you know, highly undesirable. So they're built with all these different protections to make sure that they never go down.
Amazing. Okay. So you mentioned three parts of a data center, I guess. I don't know if that's the right terminology, but storage, compute, network. And is there one data center for storage, one for compute, one for network, and then some do all three, or like do they specialize? Like how does that work?
No, that's a great question. And so if you look at what some of the largest groups have done historically, so, and most people are actually familiar with these, there's a massive Google data center in Iowa, right on the Nebraska border. There's a massive Microsoft data center in Iowa as well, I believe. And so those, I think, are more typically like the storage, like these massive storage mechanisms. They may be doing some compute. They're like kind of massaging the data, but they're not servicing their customers from that central location because it's so far from the users. You know, there's obviously not a ton of population base in those Midwestern states. So typically what you'll see is kind of like core data centers, which are kind of in big population centers, which will house a lot of the information needs to service those big population centers. And there's some exceptions to this, but then you'll hear the term edge. Well, they'll push out like more like a subset of the data that's in the core to the edge, and where some computations are done, let's say closer to the user. And so one of the big, I guess, decision points in data center decision making is what's called latency. So how long it takes the information to get from the data center to the user, typically a phone or a computer. And so if you have your Google and you have a ton of information in Des Moines, Iowa, well, you're going to push out some of that information to Dallas and Washington, D.C. and L.A. and New York, so that the information that is needed quickly can be accessed quickly from those locations. And then they'll have kind of the central repository more centrally. So you'll see almost like this hub and spoke model, both in a city versus and also in like a region, where data is allocated or aggregated in larger data centers, and it's pushed out to these, call them edge data centers. So they can be, you know, if a core data center is 30 megawatts, the edge may be 2 to 3, 2 to 4. And so it's like real hyper-targeted specific information to be pushed out to those users. Yeah, not glitchy.
So I'm in Chicago. So if I Google something, this is a random example. I Google something, maybe the compute happens in Chicago, but the storage of the info is in Iowa. Is that like how it would work? Or could it all be under one location?
You know, I think, and this is honestly even going a little bit beyond the purview, because we don't necessarily care for the services we deliver what's in the data center. It's really more about the data center, but I'll do my best to answer that question. I certainly think they push out a lot of the actual content to the regions and the hubs, I'm sorry, and even the spokes. Then like, I would think like, for the example you provided, like your Google Maps search history, or your internet search history, or your Facebook activity history, those types of logs that are probably not hypercritical to day-to-day functioning, those are probably more the things that are going to be put in those large central repositories. Whereas things like a Google Maps example we talked about, that's probably more, I would think, pushed out so that it's retrievable really quickly. Like, so for your example, you know, how long do you wait on a web page before you move off if it's you're getting spinny wheel? You know, for most people, it's just a few seconds. And so These companies are really smart. They know exactly, they're really good at predicting what content people want and making sure that it's available very quickly. And in those cases, typically it's going to be pushed out to the markets versus housed somewhere centrally.
And you keep referring to the data centers as like, you said like this has this many watts, or I forget the exact terminology, gigawatts or something like that. And so does that denote size? And also like, why are these located in like middle of nowhere Iowa? You know, is there like a power source there that is cheap to use the power of this stuff? Or like, why is that?
Yeah. So you touched on two like really important points. One is how the data center is measured. And two is like how companies decide where to put their capacity. So there certainly is a square footage component, but when companies lease from a data center, they're leasing access to, you can think of it in the most simplest terms, power, space, and cooling is what it's called. So that's a piece I didn't mention earlier, but these servers generate a ton of heat. And so not only do they take a ton of power to power them, but you have to have additional power to cool them. So a typical rental or a lease agreement for a data center would be, I need 500 kilowatts of energy, and then you're renting it on a rental rate, say it's $115 per kilowatt per month. And on top of that, you'll pay for the actual electricity you use. And so that's how they're structured. There is some loose correlations between megawatts and square footage, like roughly 1 megawatt to 10,000 square feet is how you can think of it. But all of the industry terms, capacity in megawatts. And so the square footage is really important. There is a component to it, but it's more, and there's some relatively, again, most companies have, if they have a certain megawatt deployment, it'll have a roughly equivalent square footage plan. And the companies will design, you can't put too much more power into a space. If you build a data center, it's got the power coming in, the feeds we talked about, it's got the generators, all to support a certain amount of, you know, servers. And so even if you wanted to, you know, ramp it up and get really dense or put in these super high capacity power servers, you know, you would have to almost re-engineer the building in order to do that. So companies design and build their data centers, and they work very closely with their customers to make sure they're delivering something that the customer actually needs. And so that's why we say, if you look at our website, you can see, you know, everything is measured in megawatts as far as the capacity of a market or the growth of a market. The second thing you talked about is like why companies choose to put their data centers in certain places. So, you know, a lot of those big deployments in the Midwest were really early on deployments in the space. And those sites are still growing, but they're also growing really nationwide and really globally. So quick primer on the North American data center market. So Northern Virginia, which is a group a region not a ton of people are super familiar with. It's the largest data center market in the world by about a factor of, depending on how you measure it, probably 3 or 4 in the entire world. And so the way we measure that, and again, talking back to your types of data centers question. So I mentioned kind of co-location data centers. So those are groups that build data centers in order to lease them to other groups. Think of building an office building that you're going to lease to, you know, a number of companies. The second type, and really more how the data center industry was born, was a company, a bank, a hospital, anybody. They typically would have, you know, a 10-story building and maybe half of one floor had a bunch of servers in it and had a couple extra air conditioners and had a couple extra locks on the doors. Those grew over time as, you know, technology increased and the needs of these companies, you know, banks built apps and they did online banking and hospitals started putting records online. So they started building, you know, kind of separate building data centers. And over time, those honestly became like just too expensive. And you got to think of the general trend of outsourcing across all businesses that came to IT infrastructure as well. So those became, they outsourced those to co-location centers. So we have enterprise, which is really a declining. If you were to look at it as a share of all data centers, it's really declining. Most companies aren't building their own data centers anymore. They're leasing. Colocation, who are doing the leasing, enterprise, which is mostly a decline. And then the third one is really hyperscale. And so the largest, call it 10 companies who are by data center footprint. So like I mentioned, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, Google, you know, IBM, Oracle, Twitter, LinkedIn, Uber, Dropbox, those companies lease a significant amount of data center space. They also build their own. So technically a hyperscale data center is an enterprise data center. It's just a company that builds and owns and operates their own data center. But the scale that they're doing it on is vastly, it's a totally different category than like, you know, even like a Bank of America or Kaiser or KPMG or not KPMG, Kaiser, like large hospital who may have a large data center footprint, but it's not even close to Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Facebook. So those are kind of the three data centers. So the real interplay is between the hyperscale and the colocation groups. We call them colo. The demand for those, if you look at, you know, if you read like an Amazon earnings report there or a Microsoft earnings report, you know, for a number of years, their cloud services business, like the Amazon Web Services or the Microsoft Azure or the Google Cloud Platform, these products were growing at 30-40% a year. And so you think about the data center space that's needed to support those. That's really the elephant in the data center room is, what are these groups doing? You know, the amount that Facebook has grown, adding to your point, the metaverse earlier and the amount of data center space they added in 2022, or at least announced plans for to support the metaverse. We don't see that slowing. I would say it is possible. And we've said this on a podcast that there is a slight slowdown, 23 versus 22. But for example, the North American data center space grew 36% in 2022, 22% the year before, 18% the year before. So it's growing a ton. And we see the same thing overseas, maybe not to the exact same extent. So the interplay between the hyperscale, those large, again, five users, the oligopsony, and the colo providers that are servicing them is really, I would say, the driving force within the space today.
Right. This is going to be maybe like either, it's such an easy question that it could be hard. Like what is the cloud? And you know, what has the cloud done to the data center space?
No, that's 100%. Great question. So those groups I mentioned, Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud, Microsoft Azure, those three groups, those are called cloud service providers. And there's other ones, IBM SoftLayer, OVH Cloud. There's some groups in Asia that are doing similar things. So a cloud is just a data center that is publicly accessible. And so you'll see when groups talk about putting their data center in the cloud. So here, this is the value proposition. You have a data center that you spend $30 million to build, and it was, let's call it 3 megawatts, 10 million a megawatt, and you're paying all the, you know, basically OPEX to service that, to pay the power, to pay the IT techs to service that. And if you want to add more capacity, if you want to add another 3 megawatts, it's another $30 million of CapEx plus the OPEX ongoing. So, or you could basically migrate that to Amazon. And the way the value of that is you basically say, we have 3 megawatts now. We think we may grow to 4 and then 5. What's really like a pay as you go. It's nearly infinitely scalable. They have a ton of hardware and software products you can basically use to match with your app or your database or your application. And so it's really the, you know, the CapEx versus OpEx model. And we've seen groups migrate, you know, and grow their presence in the cloud a ton. So all of those cloud products, when you put your data in the cloud, it's just going to an Amazon data center. And the way, but you know, you may not be, there's various tiers where you don't specify the specific server, or there are tiers where you do specify the specific server that your data is housed on. Again, nearly infinite tiers of security and scalability and, you know, services that you can add onto that. So yeah, not a stupid question at all, but yeah, the cloud is typically, it's just a data center, and but it's not like your data center, it's leased. And some, again, groups will say, we need to service this application out of kind of the way that Amazon and all these groups divide up their cloud services by region. So you have like a US West 1, a US West 2, US East, and below those are like sub-regions to get more and more specific. But some groups have very specific requirements where we need to service this, you know, app out of this region because it has a very high very low latency requirement. So it needs to be less than 10 milliseconds or less than 5 milliseconds, or ULL, ultra low latency, like can be like down to the 2 to 3 milliseconds range. So certain apps, again, it's a little bit beyond my scope, but I know there are requirements out there that say, hey, we have to be really, really close. And that's one of the reasons why Northern Virginia has grown so much, because, you know, it's a fascinating history, but the history of the Northern Virginia data center market kind of goes back to the early 90s with like AOL's headquarters were there in Northern Virginia. And then that kind of coupled with all of the governmental groups that were there, who, you know, in order to have a redundancy for anything that was in DC, put data centers in Northern Virginia. Data centers just beget more data centers, where once there's a group of data centers in one spot and there's a bunch of data there, if you're a company that, you know, for example, one of your clients has a lot of their data in Amazon's cloud, well, you want to be right there so you can connect to it quickly. And there's a cost to that transport. So that's why you've seen Northern Virginia just mushroom, and other groups, other, you know, markets that have had some success, it continues to explode.
So, and you mentioned that companies, I think you called it enterprise, I believe, companies that are actually building out their own data centers, is there any growth there, or is that just decreasing and everyone's going cloud pretty much?
I would say it's majority, if not exclusively, decreasing. We see very, very few companies building their own data centers, and they're either going one of two things. They're putting some of their stuff in the cloud and some of their stuff in a co-location facility. And there's various reasons for that, be it security or, you know, like financial companies or healthcare companies will say like, you need to have like in there, like whatever it is, SOC 1 or ISO 9000, whatever it is, certification, they would say, hey, your data needs to be on a physical server that you own. And so for those types of things, they would put some of that in a co-location facility with maybe a locked cage. And then the rest goes in the cloud, where you don't specify what physical server it is on. You just know it's in the cloud. Yes, very few companies build in their own data centers. It's going split into cloud and colo.
How much of the, I guess, internet or web is powered by data centers?
I mean, I think it's like 99.9%. I mean, nearly all websites have to be housed on a server. Now, if you're saying like data center versus
enterprise, somebody's, like the actual company's hosting.
Oh, yeah. Probably 80 to 90% data center. Wow. And then, you know, 10 to 20% out of enterprise. And again, a lot of those enterprises, they're not public internet. So if those stats I just referenced would be like total capacity, if you're looking at actual like www.internet, it's probably 90 plus out of a data center.
Wow. Okay. And you mentioned something called hyperscale. And what is hyperscale? And I guess like, what are the other scales?
Really, hyperscale is the only scale. And it just refers to, again, like those 5 to 10 of the largest customers, again, these are groups that both build their own data centers and lease their own data centers, or they lease data from co-location operators. So those groups will account for, you know, anywhere from 60 to 90% of all activity, depending on the quarter. That can vary, it can go up and down. But so those groups, it's really 5 to 10 customers that are really buying everything in the space. So you can imagine what kind of, you know, pressure these groups put themselves under to deliver a product that meets these companies, you know, both their timeline, their location, and their pricing, you know, to meet all of those things for those big companies. So those groups are referred to as hyperscale. And you may get a different definition or a different list depending on who you ask, but there'd be pretty broad agreement on, again, the top 5 to 10 as far as who these groups are.
And this is kind of a separate topic a little bit, but is it problematic that there's just a handful of companies that are really driving this push towards cloud? Like, I guess there's more efficiencies with you know, that scale, but I don't know, is there any issues relating to like, I don't know, security or something like that, if there's only a few players?
Yeah, I think these groups have done a pretty good job at, you know, building something that meets the needs of their customers. In the cases that I mentioned where it can't, it's really driven by some larger, you know, compliance that they've got to have, like again, financial and healthcare companies. So I think, you know, from an antitrust standpoint, certainly having three big cloud players is, I think, would give me some assurances. And there's groups that are rising to the challenge, like some of those kind of tier two, that's a rough term that I use, tier two cloud, like again, Oracle, IBM are certainly knocking on the door as far as growth. Like there's OVH cloud and there's some regional players. There's some groups that build, you know, maybe service just one or two markets that deliver a cloud-like platform. So there are options out there. You know, it's really more like on the pricing side and the development side. You know, those groups, you know, they really held a lot of power up until probably a year ago, as far as setting the terms of leasing and development. So it's really an interesting dynamic. Now that power started to shift as, you know, there's really just a lot of, that's probably another dynamic worth discussing is like power is getting harder to come by, land is getting harder to come by in some of these really key markets. And in addition to that, there's a lot of pressure on these companies to deliver power sustainably. And if you think about, you know, a 50 megawatt data center, I don't remember the exact stat, but I think a megawatt is X number of homes. There's a, you know, rough math. I think it's in the hundreds. So you think a 50 megawatt data center is maybe several thousands of homes worth of power. And so when you're, you know, when the Northern Virginia data center market is growing by hundreds of megawatts per year, you know, you can see where that type of power consumption is going to get noticed. And so again, there's a lot of pressure on these groups to develop green, both internally from their own shareholders versus from their customers are saying, hey, we want a data center that's powered, you know, sustainably. So there's a lot of pressure. But again, you heard the growth statistics, you know, 30% growth, 35% growth in last year in 2022. So kind of have these, you have a lot of pressure building up in the industry. And what that does is, you know, it will drive demand from Northern Virginia into Dallas, into Atlanta, into Chicago. It'll drive stuff out of Northern California into Salt Lake and Reno and Denver and Phoenix. So it's still an industry very much that is maturing with regards to figuring out how to navigate all those things.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned the land and the power. Land is shocking to me just because it's like, you know, America is pretty large, you know, overall, but there's a lot of empty space. Are you talking about because it has to be like, you know, near New York City or near Dallas or whatnot? Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the power, you know, I always think about whenever you're talking about this power and these data centers, I keep going back to like Bitcoin miners and crypto miners, mm-hmm. where usually they're located by like some sort of, you know, river that has a power plant or like a oil and gas field, like in Texas, where they're using like the excess flare gas to power some miners. Yeah. Tell me about this dynamic of like, hey, we're running out of land and, you know, everything's very power hungry. So they're trying to go more renewable.
It really is land that's very close to the existing data centers. And so, you know, if you look at Northern Virginia, where, you know, 10 years ago, you could have got land for maybe a couple $100,000 an acre, that would be considered prime location. Now that's $4+ million an acre. And again, that's really driven by some of that latency that I talked about earlier. So a kind of a shock value stat for you is there's a crossroads in Northern Virginia, in Ashburn, it's called the heart of the internet. And it's estimated that 70% of the world's internet traffic travels through that intersection there. And so being very close to that is highly valuable. And again, there is only so much land. And so as you get further out, instead of, you know, there being an additional cost for land, there's an additional cost to get the data in and out and kind of pay that transport tax, as it were, in the form of latency. So that's one of the reasons land is driven up. It's really just not that we're running out of land, but the land that's really prime. So you're starting to see companies will buy office developments and knock them down or repurpose industrial land.
Is that location of the land, is that dependent on where the literal fiber optic cables are like laid, or what is determining that, just besides being close to all the other data centers?
Yeah, it really is. So it's proximity to existing data centers, it's proximity to fiber, because there's a cost to run fiber. I think, you know, maybe 10 to 20K per mile. I could be wrong. It could be 50K, but it's in that range. Proximity to existing power. So in a market like Northern Virginia, that's not really a concern because all the current power is spoken for. So it's really conversations with the power operators about how quickly can you get power to a site. But there's an interesting group that's doing some work up there called Quantum Loophole. So they bought a big parcel of land about, what is it, 40 miles, 20 miles. It's 20 miles north of the heart of Ashburn. And they're spending all this money to run this huge, what they call a fiber ring, up to Frederick, Maryland and back down. So it's going to be highly connected to the heart of the internet, to Ashburn, but up in a place where the power and the land were much cheaper. I think it was like, I don't remember the exact value, maybe in the $100,000 or $40,000 an acre versus the millions of dollars per acre. So they traded a land cost for the money they had to put in to build that fiber ring. So there's companies that are getting creative. There's, you know, the other trend we're seeing is groups kind of moving to where the power exists. So existing data, you know, or existing power plants, you know, can we attract data centers to be near us? Just like you mentioned with the crypto, there's typically some latency challenges with doing that, but it is something that people are looking at more than they used to be. Yeah, it's important, I think, to note, like the crypto, we had a lot of people reach out to us from a crypto standpoint, probably 2 years ago, that tapered off a little bit, I think, you know, coincident with the price of Bitcoin or crypto.
Tapered a bit or tapered a lot?
Tapered a lot. Yeah. But those groups typically, they don't need a full-blown data center. You know, we heard stories of people running Bitcoin mining operations out of like a shipping container. As long as they have the power, there's a blip or a slight interruption in the power supply, it's not catastrophic for those groups. They just, everything turns back on and you've lost, you know, if you go down for 10 minutes, you've lost, you know, 10 minutes of the day. Whereas for an e-commerce site, it can be much more costly. So we had a lot of groups reach out. It wasn't always a good fit because again, they're not looking for a data center. They're not looking for the information we provide. They're looking for a lot of power, a big old building, and a place to put some servers. And so, and a lot of, you know, traditional data center operators, they really shied away from, you know, Bitcoin mining operations because these groups were, you know, for a long time, kind of fly by night where they'd show up, they'd want sign a huge lease. And then, you know, 6 months later, they'd just move out, leave all their stuff. And so there was this kind of tentative approach between the data center industry and the, you know, crypto industry as far as putting workloads. I mean, you still don't see a ton of crypto workloads in traditional data centers, but they're kind of dancing with each other. They may be vying for the same land. They may be vying for the same power, but they're not truly customers of one another.
Yeah, the power aspect of data centers. I guess I get people were angry or have been angry in the past. I guess not so much anymore. That crypto was using a lot of power for the mining of cryptocurrency because they're like, it doesn't make any sense. It just mine this crypto. You know, of course, there's arguments on both sides. But then for this, I couldn't imagine people are that angry for power-hungry data centers just because data centers are powering like the internet and like everything that we're using. But you did mention that they're trying to go more green and more renewable. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense in a world where like you're mentioning these growth rates of like 30% like per year, which is outrageous. Mm-hmm. So like you can't compete with fossil fuels and like renewables can't compete with that. That type of growth. So what are people in the data center world doing to I guess go more energy friendly?
They're really doing everything. You know, I would say just to take one step back on that question, like where you've seen community pushback against the data centers, they're really not pushing back. I guess individuals are not pushing back on the power usage because it doesn't affect them. You know, as long as you've got power to your house, it's not like when a data center goes next door, it sucks all the power up and you're having outages. I mean, they've figured that piece out at least. They're really, you know, they're pushing back on the way they look. You know, they're typically big, not extremely aesthetically pleasing buildings. That's changing. Another thing they have to do is like they have to run their generators periodically to test them. And that generates a little bit of noise pollution. So they've had to do some mitigation there. So the community pushback is not on the power side. It's really the corporate pushback. So large customers, leasing from the data center, are pushing that. And again, their own shareholders are pushing that. And you're absolutely right. You know, if the data center industry never grew another megawatt, it would take a number of years to, you know, replace the current fossil fuel setup with some type of sustainable. Now, that's not to stop them from trying. And groups are taking all number of approaches versus, you know, kind of the lowest level is where you can kind of do like the carbon offset, you know, purchasing those offset credits versus helping to fund a wind farm or a solar farm or, you know, some type of storage facility so that you can kind of smooth out the peaks and valleys of wind and solar. So these groups are really kind of looking at every approach. And I would say you can look at the stats and maybe be a little bit discouraged about the amount of work that's to be done. But, you know, all of these groups, I think, are working pretty hard in earnest to, they've all set targets. All these large groups have set targets to be, you know, 100% carbon neutral or green, or you really have to dig into what those definitions mean. You know, to be honest, is like, are they replacing? Are they truly not, you know, generating any carbon? Is every, you know, light switch they turn on at Google powered directly from some green energy source, or is it offset, or is it some other way? So there's really a big push now to just agree on the terms. And so there's been a number of kind of para industry groups that have said, hey, let's try and build a coalition, set the terms. And then once we've all agreed to the terms, we can set some targets to help get there. It is one of the big pressures on the industry to do that. But again, you don't see it slowing any of the actual development and growth that's happening. I'm not saying they're being hypocritical or talking out of both sides of their mouth, but you know, there's still businesses to be run. And so they're going to do everything they can to be sustainable, but they're also, you know, not going to turn down a 100 megawatt lease if it comes to them.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole ESG movement, I think, has been proven to be a little bit of a scam, like not a scam, but just kind of like a distraction. I've even seen, I think it was Blackstone or BlackRock, I forget, but even they're saying, hey, we're not really focusing so much on ESG anymore. It's kind of not relevant to our business, which I think ESG made much more sense in a world of low rate environment where mm-hmm. you know, the rates were minimal. And now that rates are going up and business is just harder in general, I feel like people are like, ESG is like, we can focus on that later. Anyway, kind of what I'm seeing, but you know, maybe data centers, it's a little bit different.
No, I think that it's certainly one of those things that gets a real critical look when things get a little tight. And again, we haven't seen people certainly abandon any of those plans, but it makes it a lot harder to have, you know, to live up to a green commitment in the face of growth, the tightening economic environment, all of the above. So yeah, it's hard. It's hard. I don't envy these guys that some of the work they've got to do to get there.
All right. I want to talk to you about the impact of AI on data centers, just because I know that AI has been like the hot thing for the past mm-hmm. year. And my understanding of OpenAI and their partnership with Microsoft was OpenAI really wanted to partner with one of these big, I guess, cloud providers because you know, AI is so hungry for compute and storage and whatever. And, you know, they chose Microsoft because, you know, I think they're one of the big five. How do you guys think about that going forward? Because AI now is like going to be everything. Therefore, mm-hmm. how do you guys position, or what do you guys think is going to happen to the market broadly?
Yeah. So I would say from where we're sitting, we see, you know, AI is more something that is going to either sustain or accelerate the growth of the cloud service providers. So what we've already seen for the last 5 years is, like you said, 30 to 40% growth in AWS, Azure, Google Cloud Platform. That's, in my mind, one of their next products that's going to continue their growth. So I would think what that, from our standpoint, that's continued growth from those groups. Potentially, you know, it lifts up some of those tier two groups that either have a competing product or have some product that interfaces with one of the larger cloud service providers. So you can kind of do a hybrid cloud or multi-cloud strategy. So I don't know that it will be a directional shift in the industry. I think it will be a, you know, a magnitude shift that it will either fuel additional growth, or if those groups, you know, you kind of heard rumblings of, hey, AWS is going from 40% growth to 35. Maybe that the implementation of those new AI products keeps their growth higher. You know, again, tracking like the individual applications that AI is working on, a little bit outside of our group's purview, but yeah, we certainly see it as something that will be, again, the amount of resources it needs, it will be, at least we hope, a continued driver of growth in space.
When you guys are looking towards the future of data center growth, is there some sort of growth plateau that you're like, oh man, once, you know, I don't know, like there's 60% of the world's online now. When we get to 95%, like our growth is going to kind of stop, or like the growth of data centers will roughly stop? Or is that not the case? I assume it's not the case, but I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, you know, there was, I think in 2018, there was a study, I think it was a Cisco or IBM. It basically said, like, remember the stat, it was either 50% of the world's data had been created in the last 2 years. Don't quote me on that specific stat, but it was something along those lines. It was shocking, an extremely high number. And if you look at any, I mean, you can Google this, just like growth of the internet or growth of whatever. All of those stats would point to the fact that, no, we're only generating more and more and more data. And we're only, our demand and appetite is only getting higher and higher for what we expect. I used to have, you know, emojis on my phone. Then I had GIFs. Now I want 4K video. Now I want an immersive HD experience. Now I want VR all on my phone or at home. And so this kind of secular demand we see is just continuing to grow. And once again, we're not experts on the growth of the internet. We see kind of the results of it, but you know, you certainly see that demand continue. And again, I think personal experience would tell us like, yeah, that's absolutely growing. Like when I go home, maybe I watch a TV show with my wife. I got three boys. They're all on switches streaming. My daughter's on an iPad, and you know, not to mention we've got a Nest and everything else that's just chewing up data. So, you know, if you told me 5 years ago that 600 megabits download for my house wouldn't be enough, I'd have laughed at you. And now we're like, kids are complaining to me that it's glitching. So again, that's just a kind of personal anecdote overlay that we certainly see the demand increasing. Now, how that plays out is, we believe, is you'll see continued spread, you know, within regions. So you see, again, Dallas, Phoenix, Chicago, Northern California, those markets were, you know, top five markets, but have seen significant growth in the last 2 years. And then you've seen the emergence of markets like Portland, you know, Denver, Minneapolis, Austin, Houston. So you'll see that you'll see the continued spread. And that's true on the global scale as well. So you see groups that are well established in North America, then go establish a European footprint and an Asian footprint, now a Latin America footprint. Eventually that's going to happen in Africa too. And so there is so much, you know, unrecognized or untapped potential to grow the space. So that's going to take a lot of, that's going to take a while to happen globally. But I think you're not going to see, I don't think, anything really plateau. If you were to look at the global data center market, I would expect no plateau or trail off, you know, anytime soon, just because, again, you know, what happens when, you know, India and China already developed, you know, technologically advanced countries, but they get to a saturation point where the US is at, where everybody's got a smartphone, everybody's got a, you know, a high definition TV. And then that happens in Latin America and it happens in Africa. So there is a lot of growth to be had. And we certainly see that happening, continuing to happen.
Yeah. So building off that, you mentioned before, you're like this, the heart of the internet in Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. And how does that make sense? Because why would European internet traffic go to Virginia, or why would Asian internet traffic go to Virginia? Can you explain that?
Yeah. I mean, in short, because it had to. You know, there was not the same data center ecosystem that was built up in Europe or APAC or Africa. And so they had to kind of fly back to Northern Virginia to, you know, there's a phrase, I think up until a couple of years ago, they said, you know, Europe is served by Northern Virginia, or Europe is served by Ashburn. Now that's becoming less and less the case now, as these countries and markets, you know, grow and they develop their own. But like, you know, Europe's an interesting one with, it's just that patchwork of different countries, and all those countries have different rules around data privacy and power usage and, you know, permitting. So that actually probably benefits the operator, because instead of doing one deal in London to serve all of Europe, they're doing five, one in London, Amsterdam, Frankfurt, Paris, Milan. But yeah, they're just, because they had to. And again, I think that stat about the percentage of traffic that goes through Ashburn will decrease as, you know, the internet grows, so to speak, or matures overseas. But yeah, that was the reality, was that it just had to be. And Ashburn had like a 15-year head start on everybody else, just right, based on how it developed.
All right. So I want to talk about investing in, I guess, data centers and this trend of kind of more, you know, more usage and more, and just general growth of the internet. And obviously this is not financial advice, but if you just had to throw out some ideas, concepts of how people, whether regular people or like large corporations, would get exposure to the growth of data centers broadly, how would people do that?
Yeah. So the easiest answer would be, you know, you can buy stock in these companies. Now, however, there's been a handful of pretty significant, like, take private transactions over the last 3 years. So there's really only three publicly traded data center REITs that are left now. And so that opportunity to invest in those groups has shrunk a little bit. So there would be kind of one option. The other option, you know, what we typically see is it's large institutional investors, and then there's a handful of very large cell towers, fiber providers, and data centers or telcos. And so they'll invest in those groups. So not being an expert in how that works, but those are the groups that are driving a lot of the growth. So it's data center operators themselves who are, you know, spending the money, partnering with, again, institutional investors or private funds to fund their growth. And it's expensive. You know, one of the things we didn't talk about, but, you know, the cost to develop a data center is, you know, can be 5 to 10x, you know, like an office building cost. And so the capital requirements are much higher in this space. So that's one thing that probably prevents the average, you know, for example, you know, I have a friend of mine who in Dallas will buy land and develop, you know, it's just him and a few other guys, and they've got some capital partners. They can go buy land and develop an office building. And they can do that, you know, successfully. I think that's harder to do in the data center space. And so you just don't see it as much, where, you know, kind of the onesie twosie developer, you see, you know, it's the bigger groups that are having the more success. They've got the existing relationships with a handful of large customers. Those groups, they're working with those groups to figure out where they want to go, and then they're executing on it. So, you know, one of the things that the rising interest rates has hurt the industry to some extent is that, again, harder to get the deals done. So if you maybe quoted, again, we talked about this on our last podcast or two ago, you know, if you quoted a deal in, you know, October of 22, and it's now March, things have changed a lot since then. And so a lot of these deals are contingent on, you know, financing being available at a certain rate. And so that's just an interesting wrinkle in this space, that it's getting a little bit harder to do, but you still see, again, very, very significant investment. That's the way we primarily see it done. Big institutions, private funds, and then you obviously the publicly traded REITs.
Yeah. So what is the average cost of a data center? Are we talking like 10 million bucks, or is it like 100 million, or like a billion? Like, what does it look like in America?
Yeah. So if you think about, you know, a 30 acre site that you paid, let's say you had to pay $1 million an acre. So there's 30 million.
And is 30 acre the average? That seems like really large.
Yeah, that's like a very average comp is a 30 acre site.
Okay.
And let's say you want to put a 30 megawatt data center on that. You're looking at about $10 million a megawatt. And that number is increasing just with supply chain, construction, labor, all those challenges. So you'd be $300 million for the building plus $30 million for the land. So you'd be 330.
And the 330 is like the average.
Yeah. And that a 30 megawatt data center is probably a little bit smaller than is being developed, you know, currently for the big customers. They're doing, you know, 60, 90, 120 megawatt leases now. And so, but that's a very like middle of the road example. So 30 megawatt data center, which would be, what is that? 300,000 square feet ish. You'd be about $330 million. And the majority of that money is spent, I think like around 60 to 70% is the generators, what are called the UPS systems, those batteries that kind of bridge the gap, the AC, all those air handlers, all that stuff that, you know, you just don't have in a, you know, office building or industrial building typically is driving a ton of that cost.
All right. So are there any technologies out there that you're aware of that are going to radically transform or have the potential to radically transform the data center industry as a whole?
Yeah, the one that is probably the most likely, and I can kind of tell you, is like liquid cooling. So normally how a data center works is you have a kind of stack of servers or a rack, and you see those sometimes in like IBM commercials, and they'll bring in like cold air will come up through the floor. And it'll get kind of sucked through. They'll kind of set up their ducting in such a way that the cold air kind of goes through the thing and sucks up the top. And then it goes out, goes to the AC unit, gets recycled. Liquid cooling. So as the technology gets more advanced and you try and kind of pack more and more stuff into one server, this generate more heat. And I think there's some actual like physical laws about number of computations equals a number of heat cast off. So as you're going to do more and more of that, you have to cool it more quickly. And the way they do that is with liquid cooling. So you basically dunk the server in like this a certain type of liquid that is circulated, and it can handle, you know, that higher processing power that generates all that more heat. So that's one. And it hasn't been like widely adopted because it's expensive, and there are some different challenges to implement it, and not everybody needs that high density deployment. So that's one. Other than that, there's not a ton of like earth shaking potential technological advancements. There's one I saw. It's almost humorous to say it, but it's the idea of storing data in DNA, and the stat that says if we could successfully store data in DNA and retrieve it, you could basically store the world's data in like a train car. Who knows if that'll ever come to pass, but there's groups who are working on different ways. It's really different ways to store data is really the key. And then, you know, the cooling stuff, and a lot of that's like incremental changes. There's not like what we see as like groundbreaking developments happening there, but groups are working on it. And I think it'll continue to get incrementally better and better, especially as groups want to deploy some of the high densities. It's going to have to be liquid cooled, but that doesn't change, you know, the need. You still have to have the power to power the servers. You still have to cool that liquid that's cooling the servers. And so really what that means is you can get funds that are focused specifically on what they're called digital infrastructure. So what that is, you can get more, you know, capacity in a smaller square footage. But as we've already talked about, you know, the square footage is kind of the lowest part of the equation when it comes to cost. So even if all these things happen, you still have to put the power in, and you still have to cool it. So it's just getting, and some of those are just, you know, physical laws of nature. It's just hard to cool stuff and hard to power stuff.
Are there any topics that I missed that you think are very important that we touch upon?
No, I think we've done a good job. We've been pretty thorough. You know, just understand again the different types, how the industry has grown, where we see it growing in the future, you know, investment in the space. Again, shameless plug, you know, we've done, I think the conversation we have today is blown out across our podcast. If anything kind of piqued your interest, there's stuff there. But no, we've certainly done a great job covering it. Hopefully it was helpful for you and your listeners.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like I just did a, you know, more than a college level course on everything data centers. It was extremely helpful. And before we jump off, I want to ask you, what are your thoughts on the metaverse? So of course, I have to ask you, like, this is a metaverse podcast. Like, what are your general thoughts on the metaverse? And what does that even mean to you?
Yeah, I see the potential of it. I see the appeal of it. You know, I've not spent a lot of time, and this is probably a reduction of the metaverse, I've not spent a lot of time with the VR headsets, certainly not an amount of time that would lead me to be like, I have a really well-formed opinion on it. But I certainly see the appeal. And again, you know, we see the impact of it as it impacts the data center space. So when Facebook ramped up a lot of their data center spending last year, in at least in theory, to support metaverse, and then they've ramped that back down as kind of they've had some challenges with the metaverse. So we're kind of seeing the back end of it. But it's hard to imagine a world in maybe it's 10 or 20 or 50 years where augmented reality is not a really big part of what we do. And that's, you know, my personal opinion. It's not really related to anything we do at Data Center Hawk, but it just seems like something that it seems like an inevitability. And again, that's again, my personal opinion, but it'll be interesting to see where it goes. But, and you know, quite frankly, I'm a little bit worried because I think there'll be some unintended consequences. I worry about my kids and what their experience with that'll be like. If hypothetically you could go through life never meeting a physical person and only dealing with people virtually, that seems odd to say the least. But yeah, those are my thoughts. I'm really interested to see where it goes.
Amazing. Awesome. Mike, well, I appreciate you coming on. It was a blast, and I will hopefully talk to you very soon.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. Great to meet you as well.
See you.